This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today, and my little car is taking a little bit longer to actually start. Instead of just going grind, grind, boom, it's going grind, 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 boom. Haven't figured out what that is yet. Not that I have tried to. I could do car mechanics. I think I would be able to accomplish that, but you know, I just have enough other things to do that when there's a problem with my little car, I just take it to the mechanic. It's Thursday today, I think I said that. Oh, today was a day. Or I'm pushing along trying to get ready for the start of a beta test a week from Monday. Was trying to get the last few things under control so we can do some exhaustive testing next week and make sure everything's good. And oh, I ran into a little thing that it should have taken me half hour, 45 minutes to do in this new tool. And there were just a few little hitches in the tool, and I end up spending 5 hours. At one time, the tool was sending me, I don't know, dozens of emails because it was caught in a loop and I couldn't get it stopped. And oh, yeah. But eventually got through it all, figured out, you know, where all the gotchas were, got around those things. There's been other little gotchas. There always is in these kind of tools. There's just always, in any kind of software, there's a few gotchas. You just got to figure out how to work around them. So, but when I left today, I had at least accomplished what I was hoping to get accomplished by about noon today. Even though it was 5:15 when I left, but at least it's done. So got some testing to do on Monday, and then we'll push some stuff out to production, and then we'll do some testing, and then we'll move some database stuff and get set up for our beta test that's coming up a week from Monday. Plus, we have a demo, hopefully, that we're going to be doing on May the 4th, which is Star Wars Day, of course. So anyways, all is well there with work. All is well with the writing. I'm puttering along. I have had a fairly easy section to write because it was all just dialogue and all just a topic that was interesting to me. I am coming to the end of that section. So we are once again in the fog, wandering around in the woods. But you know, it's going to be okay. I kind of know where we're going. It's going to be okay. Yeah, so we'll see. I kind of know where I'm going for another chapter, and then we go from there. It's amazing how it opens up when you actually get there. I heard once a teacher talking about the fact that when the children of Israel crossed the Red Sea, coming out of Egypt, Moses stretched forth the staff, the seas parted, and they walked through. But when they got to the Jordan, the feet of the priest actually had to get down into the water. And that's, you know, I find that that's the way things work out. I just gotta start walking down into the water, and then finally it opens up and it's like, hey, there it is. Anyways, so writing is good, work is good, family's good. Everything's good. I had a dinner with a friend on Tuesday, and we wandered back onto a topic that we've been on before, and we talked our way around it for a little bit on the legalization of drugs, the decriminalization of drugs. And then I came across a TED Talk. And the guy was saying a lot of the stuff that I have been feeling about this whole issue. I think I did a podcast on some of this, but it's a new TED Talk, so I get to talk about it again. My big thing with making drugs illegal and criminalizing drugs, there's a couple of big things about it. One, I think we should have learned our lesson with Prohibition many years ago. If we had learned our lesson with Prohibition, we would not be in the present state that we are in. That's the first thing. And then second thing, by criminalizing illicit drugs, you lose an entire revenue stream to the government. Why don't we make this legal? Let the government make money. You know, and I know there's a lot of people that are concerned about what would that do to our society? What would it do to our kids? What would it do to this, that, and the other? And the guy in his TED Talk covers some of this stuff. So I have to say that I'm pretty much in agreement with everything the guy says in this TED Talk. I will make note where I am not, and then I will have a little final word. He started off his talk by talking about what has the war on drugs done to the world. And this is one of the big things that, oy, what we have done to Mexico. He said, look at the murder and mayhem in Mexico, Central America, and so many other parts of the planet. The global black market estimated at $300 billion a year. Prisons packed in the United States and elsewhere. Police and military drawn into unwinnable war that violates basic rights, and ordinary citizens just hope they don't get caught in the crossfire. And he said, and in spite of all that, more people are using drugs than ever. He said, it's my country's history. He was in Brazil when he gave this talk, so he's talking about USA. He says, my country's history with alcohol prohibition and Al Capone times 50. I mean, it's just... And he went on to talk about why it's so galling to him that the U.S. has been the driving force behind this global drug war. So when you ask so many countries why they are criminalizing drugs they've never heard of, they will say, well, because the U.S. treaties emphasize criminalization over health. And when you say, well, why does most of the money worldwide for dealing with drug abuse go to punishment, and they say, well, that's what the U.S. does. And he said he's gotten to the place where he doesn't necessarily think about the global drug war as any sort of rational policy. It is simply the international projection of a domestic, i.e. U.S., psychosis. He said there is a bit of good news. He said because now it's the Russians that are leading the global, leading the drug war and not us. So at least we're doing a little better. He said, and many of the politicians want to roll back the drug war. Put fewer people behind bars, not more. And he said, as far as he's concerned, he's proud to say that he's American now that they are leading the world in reforming marijuana policies. Again, whatever you think about marijuana, I mean, I personally don't smoke marijuana because I've never found the need, and I have talked to people who do, and, you know, I'll say, I don't want to mess up my brain chemicals. I like my brain chemicals just like they are, and people will say, well, I don't. Okay, well... And I had one buddy, he said, well, I just use it to take the edge off. And I said, why do you need to take the edge off? That's what Jesus is for. Why don't you pursue him and he will take the edge off? But he couldn't. No, I just like the marijuana. Okay, well, there you go. But we are close now to some sort of a national policy, at least on marijuana. And as far as I'm concerned, it will be better if we just grow all the marijuana here in the United States and earn sales tax on it. You know, Colorado is bringing in a tremendous amount of money into its state coffers because they have done just this. You put it out through government licensed dispensaries. You have quality control against it. It gets raided. It's out in the open. There's not all this stuff that are going on. So he said that how he ended up working on this to end the war of drugs. He said he started out in a fairly religious family, moral, eldest son of a rabbi. And then he said, I smoked some marijuana and I liked it. And he said, and I like drinking too. He said, but to him, it was obvious that alcohol was the more dangerous of the two. And I have not tried either. But I've had a sip of alcohol. That's it. I didn't like it because it was too sweet. And I thought, there's so much sugar in this. He said he really didn't understand why people could get busted for smoking marijuana, but not for drinking alcohol. And he said he actually wrote his PhD dissertation on international drug control. And he brought out some pretty interesting things. Now, these are his opinions, okay, and this is what he said in his talk. Sometimes people can skew facts to make them sound better. But this is what he said. He said, you know, there's never been a drug-free society. He said, virtually every society has ingested psychoactive substances to deal with pain, increase our energy, socialize, and even commune with God. He said, our desire to alter our consciousness may be as fundamental as our desires for food, companionship, and sex. So our true challenge is to learn to live with drugs so we can cause the least possible harm and in some cases the greatest possible benefit. Now, I'm not against what he's saying there because this is the problem for me. Yes, I understand that illicit drugs cause harm. I understand that. They cause harm to people. I understand that. But our solution is far worse at this point. We are putting too many people in jail. We are just destroying the countries to the south of us because that's how the drugs come through. The amount of money that we are allowing to flow out of this country because we are selling illicit drugs and none of that is being taxed and none of it's contributing to the GDP. It's just crazy. He goes into a section that's interesting. Take it with a grain of salt because I haven't researched any of this. He says, I'll tell you something else I learned. The reason that some drugs are illegal and others are not has almost nothing to do with science or health or the relative risk of drugs, and almost everything to do with who uses and who is perceived to use particular drugs. In the late 19th century, when most of the drugs that are now illegal were legal, the principal consumers of opiates in the U.S. were middle-aged white women, using them to alleviate aches and pains when few other analgesics were available. And nobody thought about criminalizing it back then because nobody wanted to put grandma behind bars. He said, but when hundreds of thousands of Chinese started showing up in the U.S., working hard on the railroads and the mines, and then kicking back in the evenings, just like they had in the old country with a few puffs on an opium pipe, that's when you saw the first drug prohibition laws in California and Nevada, driven by the racist fears of Chinese transforming white women into opiate addictive sex slaves. And this justification of they're going to come and take our women, or they're going to come and rape our women, or our women are going to run off and want to be with them. That justification through history has been used to validate horrific acts of cruelty. You know, as soon as it looks like the women might be going a different direction, the men rile up. He says the first cocaine laws similarly prompted by racist fears of black men sniffing that white powder and forgetting their proper place in Southern society. And the first marijuana prohibition laws were all about fears of Mexican migrants in the West and Southwest. He said if the principal smokers of cocaine were affluent older white men and the principal consumers of Viagra were poor young black men, then smokable cocaine would be easy to get with a prescription from your doctor, and selling Viagra would get you 5 to 10 years behind bars. Okay, now I don't know about that, but, you know, it's an interesting comparison. He says that what drives him to shame, living in an otherwise great nation, is that we have less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's incarcerated population. Which, those statistics are staggering. They're just staggering that it's actually that high. There's a policeman going up to see the old property there at Crystal Cave. That's an interesting place for him to pull in. He said, it's the people I meet who have lost someone they love to drug-related violence or prison or overdose or AIDS because of the drug policies emphasize criminalization over health. It's the good people who have lost their homes, their jobs, their freedom, and even their children to the state, not because they hurt anyone, but solely because they chose to do one drug instead of another. Now, he does freely admit that he's torn. He said, 3 days a week, I think, yes, we should legalize everything. 3 days a week, I think, no. And he said, on Sundays, I'm an agnostic. He said, but since today is Tuesday, let me say that legally regulating and taxing most of the drugs that are now criminalized would radically reduce crime, violence, corruption, black markets, and the problems of adulterated and unregulated drugs would improve public safety and allow taxpayer resources to be developed for useful purposes. Because we are spending a ton of money on prohibition, and it doesn't work. He said there's always going to be a demand. There's always going to be a supply. You can knock out one source, it'll come back. He said, people tend to think of prohibition as the ultimate form of regulation, when in fact it represents the abdication of regulation with criminals filling the void. That's a good point. Which is why putting criminal laws and police front and center in trying to control a dynamic global commodities market is a recipe for disaster. And what we really need to do is to bring the underground drug markets as much as possible above ground and regulate them as intelligently as we can to minimize both the harms of drugs and the harms of prohibitionist policies. You know, I heard someone say as a joke that really what we need to do is we need to legalize drugs and then put the government in charge of its manufacture because then, for sure, they will go out of business. Anyways, so the question then becomes, all right, so if you do that, if you legalize drugs, are more people going to use drugs? And he says, he was talking specifically about marijuana. He said, maybe, he said, but it's not going to be young people because it's going to be legalized. It's not going to be legalized for them. Well, maybe young people. And quite frankly, they already have the best access to marijuana. I think it's going to be older people. It's going to be people in their 40s and 60s and 80s who find they will prefer a little marijuana to a drink in the evening or the sleeping pill. Or maybe that it helps their arthritis or diabetes. Or maybe helps spice up their long-term marriage. Everybody's looking to spice up their marriage, you know. And that just might be a net public health benefit. And he cites other countries, Portugal. You know, nobody goes to jail in Portugal for possessing drugs. And the government has made a serious commitment to the treatment of addiction as a health issue. He said Switzerland, Germany, the Netherlands, Denmark, England. said, where people who have been addicted to heroin for many years and repeatedly tried to quit and failed can get pharmaceutical heroin and helping services in medical clinics, because this is an emphasis on helping people recover rather than criminalizing. I'm getting my mail. One moment. He said, look at New Zealand, which recently enacted a law allowing certain recreational drugs to be sold legally, provided their safety had been established. He said, look here in Brazil, where he's giving the talk, and some other countries where a remarkable psychoactive substance, ayahuasca, can be legally bought and consumed, provided it's done within a religious context. Look in Brazil, Bolivia, and Peru, where all sorts of products are made from the cacao leaf, the source of cocaine, and are legally sold over the counter with no apparent harm to people's public benefit. He said, I mean, don't forget Coca-Cola had cocaine in it until 1900, and so far as we know, was no more addictive than Coca-Cola is today. And of course, on top of all of this, we have things that are currently being sold. I'm backing into my garage. Like cigarettes. He's talking about heroin addicts at one point, and he said, heroin addicts, when asked, will tell you that getting off cigarettes is far harder than getting off cocaine, or far harder than getting off heroin. I mean, there's just such inequities in here that there's not really any reason for them. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. As far as he's concerned, the challenges we face today are twofold. The first is the policy challenge of designing and implementing alternatives to the ineffective prohibitionist policies. But the second challenge is tougher because it's about us. The obstacles to reform lie not just out there in the power of the prison industrial complex or other vested interests that want to keep things the way they are, but within each and every one of us. It's our own fears, our lack of knowledge and imagination that stand in the way of real reform. And ultimately, I think it boils down to the kids and to every parent's desire to put our baby in a bubble and the fear that somehow drugs will pierce that bubble and put our young ones at risk. In fact, sometimes it seems like the entire war on drugs gets justified as one great big child protection act, which any young person can tell you it is not. He said, here's what I'd say to teenagers. First, don't do drugs. Second, don't do drugs. Third, if you do drugs, there are some things I want you to know, because my bottom line as your parent is come home safely at the end of the night and grow up and lead a healthy and good adulthood. That's my drug education mantra, safety first. I think it's a good TED Talk. They did ask him afterwards. Chris Anderson came up. He said, because he got a big reaction from the crowd. He said, wow, that's quite the reaction. He said, I'm guessing that some people here and maybe a few watching online, maybe someone knows a teenager or a friend or someone who got sick, maybe died from some drug overdose. I'm sure you've had these people approach you before, so what do you say to them? And he said, the most amazing thing that's happened of late is I met a growing number of people who have actually lost a sibling or child to a drug overdose. And 10 years ago, these people just wanted to say, let's all line up all the drug dealers and shoot them, and that will solve it. And what they've come to understand is that the drug war did nothing to protect their children. If anything, it made them more likely that those children were put at risk. So now they're becoming part of the drug policy reform movement. There's other people who have kids. One's addicted to alcohol, the other one's addicted to cocaine or heroin, and they ask themselves the question, why does this kid get to take one step at a time and try to get better, and this one's got to deal with jail and police and criminals all the time? So everybody's understanding the drug war's not protecting anybody. All that's very good. And I, as a follower of Jesus Christ, actually have an addition to all of that. Because I really think that as we support the drug war, we really abdicating our personal responsibility as followers of Jesus Christ. Because Jesus said that we are supposed to be salt and light. That we are in the world seasoning the world. And it's just too easy. You know, when there's people taking drugs, for us to say, well, that should be criminalized and someone should come arrest them and someone should throw them in jail. It's just too easy to abdicate our responsibilities, because our responsibilities really as salt and light is to be friends and to be relationship with people, even people who are drug addicts. And if the Church of Jesus Christ was spreading his kindness and his love and his generosity and his mercy and his grace, and if we weren't all bottled up and we had more influence, maybe we wouldn't need so many people to be put in jail because they were tied up with drugs, because maybe we would be leading them to Jesus Christ and discipling them and bringing them to a point where they had the joy and the glory that there is in having a relationship with Jesus. And the sad part is that we do have many children who are in the church. We are not only reaching those, we are not only not reaching those who are outside the church, we do have many who are inside the church who have experimented with drugs, who are becoming hooked on drugs. Because something went wrong inside the church and they never really developed that full, rich relationship with Jesus Christ. So that they didn't need something to take the edge off. They had Jesus for that. This is Phil Ferrand, and I have made it home.